have this announcement today, I think, is very good news for the country and certainly for Alaska.
Alaska's congressional delegation cheers as the federal government approves the controversial Willow oil drilling project. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 13th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, Ryan Reddington arrives in White Mountain in good position to win the Iditarod.
It's like a childhood dream, you know, like I'm coming alive here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The Biden administration announced this morning that it's approving a permit for Willow. That's the $8 billion ConocoPhillips project in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, the largest oil development in Alaska since the 1990s. And Sunday night, ahead of the Willow announcement, the administration said it would impose new restrictions on drilling in the NPRA. Joining us to explain is Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin. Hi, Liz.
Hey, Wesley.
So, Liz, this is a victory for Conoco and everyone else who lobbied to get the Willow permit approved, right?
Yeah, the administration approved three drilling pads for Willow, which amounts to about 219 oil wells. That's the same number as the Bureau of Land Management recommended in January. Conoco had originally wanted five drilling sites and 250 wells, so it's slightly scaled back, but proponents of Willow are calling this a big win. Certainly the congressional delegation is, so are groups on the North Slope that have been lobbying for Willow.
So what are these drilling limitations the Biden administration announced on Sunday night, and what's the deal with this Sunday night announcement?
Yeah, it was weird. What kicked it off, I think, is that Friday, Bloomberg reported, based on unnamed sources, that the administration was going to approve Willow. And then a whole bunch of other media outlets reported this, also based on unnamed sources. Then the reaction started pouring in from conservation groups and climate activists and other people who wanted to stop Willow. And I think the Interior Department announced these protections when they did to try to blunt the criticism.
Did it work? The criticism from environmental groups still seems pretty loud today.
Right. I'd say it didn't work, but it does add a smaller headline under the main one today. The main headline is Biden allows Arctic oil development and raging climate advocates. And then the smaller one is, but he's also imposing some limits on Arctic drilling.
What are the limitations? And do you think they're going to hinder future developments beyond Willow?
We don't really know much about the impact these measures will have and whether they'll apply at all to land that's already under lease. But we've got two categories of government action here. One is that the Interior Department says they are working on new rules that would limit development or protect, depending on how you want to view this, 13 million acres of the reserve. That's more than half of the NPRA. The press release says it would seek the highest level of protection for at least some of the acreage, and that the limits would be applied to land already deemed sensitive or special. So we don't really know the details, and we likely won't until the proposed rules are put out for public comment, which the Interior Department says will be in a few months. Okay, so that's the rules for NPRA. The administration also announced that President Biden will remove 2.8 million acres of the Beaufort Sea from possible consideration for oil lease sales. That's a strip of the Beaufort that was the only remaining part of the Arctic Ocean under U.S. control that might have been considered for offshore drilling. And that's because in 2016, President Obama put almost all of the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas off limits.
So the Willow Project has faced criticism from some indigenous groups and some conservation groups for years, but it recently started to trend nationally through some coordinated social media advocacy, especially through the app TikTok. Can you talk about how that advocacy influenced the decision in the last week?
Well, I'm not sure how much influence it had, since ultimately the decision didn't go their way. But it certainly brought the debate to a lot more people, and very quickly. It kind of put Willow on the map, nationally speaking, especially for younger people who care a lot about stopping climate change. I think that awareness and that activism does not disappear. I think we'll see a replay when Arctic developments are debated in the future.
And lastly, do you expect environmental groups will challenge this decision in court?
Absolutely, and soon.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Liz. That's Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reporting from D.C. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation is asking for public comments on new regulations for siting small nuclear reactors, like the one the military proposes to set up at Owsen Air Force Base to generate electricity for the installation. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
DEC released draft regulations on Thursday that outline the process of applying for a permit to build or install a nuclear facility in Alaska. According to an agency news release, the regulations were drafted in response to the Air Force's plan to site a microreactor at Eielson that'll begin generating up to 5 megawatts 4 years from now. That's about a third of the electrical output of Eielson's existing coal-fired heat and power plant. The microreactor, about the size of a railroad boxcar, would provide backup for the 70-year-old power plant. The new regulations would require applicants intending to set up a nuclear facility to, among other things, obtain a siting permit from DEC and to get approval from cities or boroughs in which the facility would be located, or the legislature for facilities proposed for unincorporated areas within the state's unorganized borough. The proposed regs wouldn't affect existing federal regulations that, among other things, require applicants to also obtain siting permits from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The NRC would continue to oversee all other aspects of the nuclear facility, including licensing, construction, operation, safety, and security. Alaskans may comment on the new regulations through May 11th by clicking on links on the DEC homepage or social media accounts. And we'll have a link in this story on KUAC's news page at fm.kuac.org. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a weight loss group with 17 chapters statewide celebrates 75 years.
That accountability on the scale is a big one. And then the support from the other members in that group is also tremendous.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
In the race to claim the 2023 Iditarod Sled Dog Race, musher Ryan Reddington was the first to reach White Mountain late this afternoon. It's the last major checkpoint, 77 miles from the finish line in Nome. Reddington is one of three Alaska Native mushers at the front of the pack and left the Elim checkpoint about 6 hours before his closest competitors, Pete Kaiser from Bethel and ENIAC's Richie Deal. Reporting from the White Mountain checkpoint, Alaska Public Media Trail reporter Ben Matheson says the front of the race looks a little different than it did at the start of the weekend.
Well, the race broke apart around Eagle Island on the Yukon River, and that's when Brent Sass, last year's Iditarod winner, scratched in Eagle Island unexpectedly because he had cracked teeth and a bad cold and was too sick to properly care for his team. So that splintered open the race. Jesse Holmes was also one of the early race contenders, but his team faded on the approach to the Yukon River and wasn't able to maintain the speeds after a taxiing effort to get to the Yukon. So with that, there's a trio of these three mushers who emerged by Caltag: Ryan Reddington, Pete Kaiser, and Richie Veal. Pete Kaiser, a past Iditarod champion, and Richie Veal and Ryan Reddington, both accomplished mid-distance mushers, mid-distance champions, but each of those two fighting for their own first Iditarod win. So those three have been pushing the pace from Caltag towards Unalakleet and up the coast. Ryan Reddington emerged right around Caltag and has been at the front essentially since Caltag. And he's expected to be the first one here in search of his first Iditarod victory.
And what can you tell us about Reddington, Kaiser, and Deal?
They're all pretty good friends. They've known each other for years, and they've been racing at Iditarod for a long time. Ryan Reddington splits his time between Kinnick and Wisconsin, and he has really deep roots in the Iditarod. His father, Joe Reddington Sr., is one of the race founders. His dad, Rainey Reddington, has raced a dozen Iditarods, and his two brothers compete too. But there's never been a Reddington Iditarod champion before, so that could be a really big deal for the race. Richie Veal's best finish is sixth place in 2022 and back in 2018, but he's won the prestigious Kuskokwim 300 Sled Dog race and has always been and has been seen as a contender for this race for years now. Kaiser's been a pretty consistent top performer in Iditarod. He's been in the top 10 in 7 of his 13 Iditarods, and he became the first Yupik musher to win the race back in 2019. So there's a lot of race experience, and all of these mushers have won races and know how to finish races when they're leading.
Sure. And how would you sum up this year's Iditarod so far? You know, are there any themes that are emerging?
There's a really small group of mushers this year. There were only 33 who started the race, which is the smallest field ever, and it's now down to 30 mushers after 3 scratched. It was a really warm race to start off. It was something where the temperatures got into the 30s, and teams would really try to stop running in the heat of the day in the afternoon. And you'd see people in the checkpoints in, you know, short sleeves and take jackets off. And it's something where that heat is hard on dog teams and really kind of drove the story for the first few days. Things have cooled down, though, and the trail set up nicely along the Yukon River to make for a hard and fast trail that teams were able to move pretty well on. And they seem to be moving pretty well along the coast as well. And then after the race broke apart at Eagle Island, we saw this trio of racers at the front with Ryan Reddington and Pete Kaiser, along with Richie Veal, all racing really fast teams and in pretty close proximity, given it's a 1,000-mile race.
So speaking of a winner, when can we expect one?
We can expect a winner to arrive in Nome sometime early Tuesday. So often it's a race to White Mountain, the last checkpoint 77 miles before the finish in Nome. That's where teams all take an 8-hour break. In this year's race, though, it has been a tight competition like we've been talking about at the front. Pete Kaiser's been resting for several hours now back in Elam. So the proximity between him and the race leader, Ryan Reddington, and the gap between Pete Kaiser and the race leader, Ryan Reddington, has grown over the course of the day. So it's not turning into a nail biter at the moment, but Pete Kaiser is a musher who knows how to finish fast. He's someone who excels on the coast, excels at having the fastest team at the end of the race. So we are still expecting this to be a hard-fought competition, and we're expecting that finish to be in Nome early Tuesday.
All right. Well, Ben Matheson is our trail reporter reporting out from White Mountain. Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Leslie.
A new ferry terminal north of Juneau is one step closer to becoming a reality. Last week, state officials signed a memorandum of understanding with Juneau's Urban Native Corporation to collaborate on construction of a ferry terminal at Cascade Point. As KTOO's Katie Anastas reports, supporters of the project say it will shorten travel time to Haines and Skagway and reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Everyone would like to welcome aboard the Taslina.
Captain Patrick Phillips knows the route from Juneau's Auk Bay to Haines like the back of his hand. He says it usually takes 4.5 hours. Departing from Cascade Point instead of Auk Bay could shave 30 miles off the trip and reduce travel time significantly.
That'll take a 2-hour bite out of that trip.
That could be enough time to fit 2 trips into 1 day. Phillips thinks the shorter travel time and potential for multiple trips per day would increase demand. That was the case when the fast ferry ran between Juneau and Haines.
we had a lot of traffic on the fast ferry because people didn't have to take their kid out of school for 3 days to go to Haines. So we may end up getting more people off the couch and on the ferry with this new terminal. That's my hope.
Standing aboard the Taslina on Thursday, state transportation officials signed a memorandum of understanding with Gold Belt Incorporated to work together to build a ferry terminal at Cascade Point. The state plans to lease the land there owned by Gold Belt. Now that the memorandum has been signed, the design process can begin. Steve Solander, Gold Belt's Vice President of Operations for Alaska, says the terminal will meet the needs of both the corporation and the state.
A memorandum of understanding allows us to negotiate and work with a pre-engineering group to design Cascade Point to the uses of DOT as well as mixed-use space for future opportunities.
Governor Mike Dunleavy was in Juneau for the signing. He said it's part of a broader effort to improve Southeast Alaskans' access to the road system.
This has been a long time coming, and we know this is a step, but this is a major step. This is really a commitment to see this through.
Along with reduced travel time, supporters of the project say there are environmental benefits. Duff Mitchell is a member of the Juneau Commission on Sustainability. He estimates that ferries burn about 250 gallons of fuel every hour. Reducing travel time and distance would reduce emissions.
And when you add that up, the amount of savings is phenomenal over a year run.
Alaska Department of Transportation Commissioner Ryan Anderson says shorter routes could make it possible to use a low-emission or electric ferry for the routes, since they have a limited range.
And as you shorten up the distances, you know, the technologies right now, they're starting to get there, where we could start considering, you know, an electric-powered ferry that would just be a shuttle between Haines-Skagway and a place like Cascade Point.
Department of Transportation spokesperson Sam Dapsovich says increasing service between Juneau, Haines, and Skagway could help the state meet demand and generate more revenue.
Well, this is one of our highest volume routes. We get a lot of traffic on it, people trying to get, and it's going to probably be even higher this year just because of how our ferry schedule worked out. So the more service we can add between here and there, the better.
He says Gold Belt and the state hope to finish the preliminary design process by the end of the year. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks with 400 guest rooms and 1,700 square feet of meeting space. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
An outdoor treasure hunt is coming to the Kenai Mountains Turnagain Arm Heritage Area this summer in a project that will combine the outdoor beauty of the region, its historical significance, and a sense of adventure. KDLL's Riley Board has more.
Geocaching is a global outdoor activity where participants look for hidden containers, called caches, which can be found at specific locations available online. They often involve hiking or some other sort of adventuring to reach. In partnership with the statewide organization Geocache Alaska, KMTA is in the process of installing a geotrail through its corridor. Emily Stewart with Geocache Alaska says a geotrail is a collection of caches in a common area that follow a theme. If participants find a certain number of the caches, they can receive a prize. Stewart says there are more than 8,000 caches in Alaska, with the greatest concentration in South Central. She says geotourism, or traveling specifically to search out geocaches, is on the rise and is particularly popular in Canada and Germany, some of Alaska's biggest visitors. The KMTA trail will contain 23 caches, 22 physical ones, and one special site called an earth cache. The sites follow the trail of KMTA's field trip guide, a pre-existing map of historical and ecological stops along the KMTA corridor, with sites in Girdwood, Cooper Landing, Hope, Moose Pass, and Seward. When participants find 20 of the 23 caches, they can redeem their success for a commemorative coin. If they find all 23, they'll receive a special Geocache Alaska souvenir. The 23rd non-physical cache is in Turnagain Pass and asks participants to observe their physical surroundings. There is also a code word hidden on a sign at that site for people to find. The trail will be maintained by a team of 10 volunteers who placed the caches originally and will check in on them periodically. Stewart says the team has worked hard to make sure the caches are around for a long time, which included placing passcode locks on some of them. Stewart has been involved in geocaching for 12 years and says for her, it's all about the joy of being taken to unexpected places. She says other than tourists, the GeoTrail is also designed for Anchorage residents who want an excuse to do more exploring on the Kenai Peninsula. The KMTA GeoTrail will go live on June 3rd, and there will be a corresponding kickoff event in Girdwood on that day. On the Kenai Peninsula, I'm Riley Ward.
Residents of the Prince of Wales Island community of Craig don't have to boil their water anymore after water samples came back clear of harmful bacteria. As KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, officials are still urging water conservation over the next 2 weeks to avoid triggering another boil water notice.
Craig's boil water notice, which had been standing since Sunday, was lifted Friday afternoon. The notice was lifted after water samples tested clear of harmful bacteria. The State Department of Environmental Conservation requires that samples be collected and tested for bacteria like E. coli after water pressure drops to below 20 pounds per square inch. Brian Templin, Craig's city administrator, says the water samples got the seal of approval from a test lab in Juneau late Thursday afternoon. The state's Department of Environmental Conservation signed off on the results on Friday.
So it's nice to be able to give the community confidence in the water that's coming out of their faucets now.
But Craig isn't out of the woods yet. Templin says there's another problem, stress on the water system.
That release of the boil water notice means that folks are likely going to be using more water for various purposes.
Templin says if too many people try to flush their taps, it'll be too much for a system that's already at critically low levels. The plant is running with two so-called treatment trains at full capacity, while the other two trains wait for new filters. He's asking community members to avoid any unnecessary water use.
We're at the point where it would not take very much for us to get back below pressure and be back on a boil water notice.
Templin says that he is working to keep residents updated via social media and the city website as things change. But the next 2 weeks will be critical to boosting water levels up. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
A weight loss group with chapters all over Alaska and the U.S. is celebrating its 75th anniversary this year. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, the nonprofit Take Off Pounds Sensibly holds weekly meetings to encourage sustainable, long-lasting weight loss.
Roughly 1 in 3 Alaskans is obese, and another third is overweight, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And losing weight is hard. Take it from this reporter who falls firmly into one of those categories. Amanda Roussel is a member of the Ketchikan chapter of Take Off Pounds Sensibly, and she says, like many things, it's easier when you have people cheering you on.
The philosophy they've always had is, first, it's based on friendship. So as members, we support each other and encourage each other.
The group, better known as TOPS, is celebrating its 75th anniversary and its 30th anniversary in Ketchikan. Roussel says she joined the group last August after struggling to tackle the city's steep streets.
I was walking up these hills in Ketchikan, and it was hurting. And I've lost this same percentage of weight more times than I'd like to mention. I'm like, I have to do something different.
She says she's had success losing weight before, like during the pandemic when it became clear that obesity was a risk factor for severe COVID-19.
And so at that time, you know, I made this very serious effort to lose weight. I lost 50 pounds in 3 months. I gained all of that back and then some.
So she started looking for something different.
What still was true then remains true now, that's still something that's going to help in mortality and morbidity, but this time, like, I have to change my mindset. I have to know what my why is, and it can't just be something I do through a fad. It's not something I can do alone, and it's not something I can do by beating myself up.
TOPS is different from some other weight loss groups that promote specific diets or exercise regimens. Instead, Roussel says members see their doctor to get an idea of what a healthy weight is and then start to take small, achievable steps towards that goal.
Sustainable and slow changes over time and lifestyle. So whether or not someone's choosing to do intermittent fasting or keto or vegan or vegetarian or portion control or moderation, that's up to them. It's just, what are the sensible choices they need to make?
Dawn Lesterson, the group's state coordinator for Alaska, puts it this way.
So basically, TOPS promotes the exchange system where you would keep track of how many macronutrients you eat, protein, carbs, fat, et cetera. But they also promote exercise. And at a meeting, when you go to a meeting, there is a program that is given by some of the people in the group. And the programs are vetted by TOPS members on the board and other health advisors. They're proven and they're effective.
She says members lean on each other for encouragement and ideas for a healthy lifestyle. Most meetings start with optional weigh-ins to keep members on track.
That accountability on the scale is a big one. And then the support from the other members in that group is also tremendous.
TOPS has 17 chapters spread all over Alaska. Ann Lesterson says that across the state, members shed more than half a ton of weight last year. That's about the weight of a grand piano. But that's not the end.
So TOPS stands for Take Off Pounds Sensibly. And when these people get to their goal weight, they are called COPS now. So they are now keeping off pounds sensibly.
Lesterson says she lost 30 pounds after joining the group in 1995, and she's successfully kept it off with the support of fellow TOPS members. There is a fee, $49 for the year, plus monthly dues averaging $5 that pay for things like awards and donations to the organizations that host the meetings. Lesterson says there are two chapters in Southeast, Ketchikan and Juneau, but all it takes to start a new one is four members, a place to meet, and a scale.
We like TOPS to grow, but we like the members to shrink.
And the first meeting is free. Roussel from the Ketchikan chapter says anyone curious should stop by.
Just come and see. Don't be embarrassed. Don't feel like there's going to be any pressure on you. Like, come and see and know that you are going to be loved and supported and have a common purpose with other people who are just trying to struggle it together.
She says there's no wrong time to start pursuing a healthier lifestyle. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Ben Matheson in White Mountain, Katie Anastas in Juneau, Reagan Miller and Eric Stone in Ketchikan, and Riley Board in Kenai. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
And by
Matson, delivering the goods and materials Alaskans depend on Facebook at Matson in Alaska. Matson, supporting public media in Alaska.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.